Hello and welcome to another episode of Series 7 of the Family Law Podcast, brought to you by Pump Court Chambers. The last two episodes have been a bit law-heavy, which you may say is unsurprising for a legal podcast, but we thought regardless we'd shake things up a little bit this time and talk about something which certainly it is different, but it still very much affects the legal profession, and that is imposter syndrome. Now, whilst I'm a barrister and so almost qualified by default to talk about imposter syndrome, we thought we'd get an actual expert on to talk about this, and I'm delighted to be joined by Samantha Hawkins, who is a coach and facilitator who transforms her clients' work lives. Welcome, Samantha.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Mark, and I'm sure you're much more of an expert than you make yourself out to be. I'm sure you could do a podcast on it by yourself, but I'm happy to share with you today, so I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. We're going to try and make sure it's not a podcast therapy session for me and keep it abstract. So the first thing, I suppose, is let's start from the beginning, whether you could tell us a little bit about imposter syndrome.
Absolutely. So imposter syndrome is basically the pervasive feeling or belief that everything you've ever achieved and every success you've ever reached has been a fluke or has been by luck and not as a result of your skills, abilities, hard work. And it leaves people feeling a bit like they at any moment they could be found out or exposed, or people will realize, or they'll make the one big mistake that will show that all of this was luck. And it's kind of like a house of cards that will fall down. And basically it amounts to the fact that people continue to have intense self-doubt no matter how much external evidence there is to say that they are successful. And so I imagine it does come up quite a lot in your profession.
I'm sure it does. How do you see it presenting amongst your clients?
That's a really good question, actually, because I maybe have a different view about this than a lot of people, because I work so much around it. Diverse leaders. I work mainly with women and ethnic minority leaders. So I see this all the time. Not that it doesn't happen with men, but I see this all the time with them. And it kind of comes up in two ways. The first way, I actually don't think is imposter syndrome, but keeps being spoken about as imposter syndrome, which is when you're really new to something, you have just been promoted, or you've got a new job, or you've started a new business, or whatever it is, that you feel lacking in confidence in that new area. Actually, to me, that's not imposter syndrome, because that's not actually a problem. If you feel like that, there's nothing wrong with you. Actually, your brain is functioning correctly. Like it's an evolutionary protection measure, right? Because if you, for example, decide to start rock climbing and you have really high confidence in your capacity to rock climb, you might try and climb a really high intensity mountain and literally fall to your death. So
for 127 hours or something, right?
Exactly. So you actually don't, it's good to have low confidence when you're new, because it makes you more alert, it makes you more open to learning, it makes you more vigilant to danger and risk, right? So in general, when people say imposter syndrome means you're just outside your comfort zone, right? For me, it's not really the same thing. I would say with an exception is if you've just got a new job and you are questioning whether you deserve to have that new job, that is a bit different. But I would say that falls into the second category. The second category is, regardless of how much experience you have, you could have been doing this job for 10 years. You could have a PhD in this subject and you still believe that you are not good enough, and your self-doubt hasn't grown with experience. It's when that confidence stays low despite your experience that the issue happens. And that's the one which really for me is a syndrome, as it were, because it really is a problem. That is, if you don't build your confidence with experience, you'll never feel it. Mm. And that really is a challenge, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the difference. We have pupil barristers. I remember in pupillage, just every case took me so long to prep because I was terrified. It was brand new, so you would expect it, but you know, now it is a different situation sometimes.
I want to say tell me about that sometimes, because the coach in me is coming out, but you know, you said you didn't want this to be a therapy session just for you, so
let's keep it but in terms of your work, so you said you work mainly with women and ethnic minorities. Is that kind of because it is more common, or is that just how it's worked out for you?
Yeah, the reason that I work with this particular group is that my passion really is around like social justice and equity and inclusion. So I'm quite dedicated. It's come the other way around, as it were. Like, I've been dedicated to working with those leaders to help increase the diversity and inclusiveness of leadership in society, because it's really problematic that it's not very diverse, right? And it's a real passion of mine. But through that coaching, I've noticed that certain topics come up all the time. And this is one that I have kind of gained some expertise around, because it is then the thing that's showing up with those clients, if that makes sense.
Mm. I mean, I suppose it leads to my next question, which you can wrap together, but the causes of imposter syndrome or anything that fits within that spectrum. Are we talking societal then, if we're working with ethnic minorities?
You know me well already. I blame everything on society. I think that is such a great question, because I think we have a tendency now to pathologize or individualize societal issues. So an example of this is anxiety disorders are real. But if you are having anxiety because of climate change, you don't necessarily have a personal anxiety disorder. You have an appropriate response to a scary external factor, right? So we do a lot of, this is an individual problem that you need to solve individually, rather than this is a social problem that we need to kind of work on together. And for me, imposter syndrome is the same. And the reason that I say that is data shows overwhelmingly that different groups suffer from imposter syndrome hugely differently. So women suffer from it a lot more severely and in a lot wider of the population than in men. Ethnic minorities suffer from it more than white people. So it leads me to question, why is that happening? That doesn't feel like it's a thing inside people. That feels like it's something about the system that we work in. And the other thing I see is clients that I have, they don't have imposter syndrome when they are doing an activity with a group of people that they trust and that trust them. They only have it at work, for example. So the environment clearly plays a role in whether it comes up. And that's made me really start to question, what role does society have here? And I could go on about this for days. So I don't know. I don't know how much you want me to share on this.
Well, I suppose going along those lines, we talk about imposter syndrome as if it's something that you can just diagnose and it's something that you have innately in you. But is it really a syndrome?
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. The original imposter syndrome originally came from a woman who is a psychologist who described it as imposter phenomenon in the 80s. So like less of a syndrome and more of a kind of phenomenon. I really like that expression. I think, yeah, calling it a syndrome then does imply that it's an individual problem. I think because it's happened so much in society that has created these conditions that people feel inadequate, you know. So for example, our measures of success are unreachably high. I mean, I imagine as barristers, you feel that all the time. The goalpost is always moving. Nothing you ever do feels like a good enough success, because success in society is measured by having everything perfect all the time, right? And because we don't share enough about our doubts with each other, we act confidently when we're not confident. And because we're conditioned in certain ways. So for example, if a woman is, you know, women are generally raised as girls to believe, just be quiet and you're not really a leader. You're just someone that should caretake. So when they're in a you know, and that's a very vast simplification, but when a woman is in a leadership position, they're not often, they feel uncomfortable because they've been told women aren't supposed to be leaders, that that's been messaged to them. And both women and men trust male leaders more than female leaders. There's a lot of data to show that. So those things are all impacting the individual. And workplaces in general are designed to make everyone homogenous, and people aren't homogenous. So they're, you know, they're, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, wherever you're from, whatever your race, you have to fit this mold. So you feel uncomfortable. All of those things are normal. But the problem is, over time, we have all internalized that as our own stuff. So it is something that has now become an individual issue, and is something that, yes, society needs to resolve and workplaces need to resolve to make sure that people don't feel that way and to get the support they need. But also, we need to do something in the inside, because it's sat with us, right?
Because I suppose it's almost that default thing, isn't it? You know, if you walk into the board of a banking company and it's just a bunch of old white men who play golf far too often, if you're a woman or an ethnic minority, you're instantly going to have that feeling of imposter. But that is the society. But you're saying that there's an individual role that needs to be played as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if I guess, like, in the utopian state of the world, which I just very much hope will one day exist, but probably won't based on human history, the societal conditions would be everyone can be their unique, fully expressed, authentic self, and everyone will be celebrated and trusted and valued, and everyone will be happy, and no one will be conditioned in any ways except the ways they want to be, and all of that. Then the individual level wouldn't really be a problem. But I think that the reason why I still think there's an individual role is actually because it's an empowering thing, right? If I just say, well, society's a problem, you're not the problem, society's the problem. Yeah, absolutely. But then you can feel like, but then there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm now stuck with this because that is how I've been raised. That is how I've been conditioned. That is how my workplace is. That is how the bank is when I walk in. That is what the board looks like. So there is kind of work that you can do on yourself in your environment so that you can navigate those challenges more easily. And that, I feel, is quite empowering to people.
Yeah. I don't want you to give away all your trade secrets, but I think
you can have them.
I think some listeners will obviously be listening to this thinking, gosh, this all sounds terribly familiar. What can I do about it? So on the individual level, how do you overcome imposter syndrome?
Mm. Yes, really good question. There are lots and lots of things you can do to overcome imposter syndrome, or to at least begin to address it and to alter your relationship with it. And, you know, call me and I can help you work on those things. But I'm happy to share any of those with you, because actually they're all things that take work. Unfortunately, there are no like really quick fixes that you can immediately now, oh, I wake up tomorrow and I feel fully confident and I will never have a wobble ever again. So they do take work, and working with a practitioner can really help. But having said that, there are things you can do like on an individual level. Some practical things, right, are one, building a community of people in which you feel trusted and safe. And if that's not at work, that's fine. But kind of a group of people that can have your back. So when you're dealing with something difficult at work, you know, oh, I can kind of message this group and I'll get a bit of a pep talk and I'll get hyped up again. That makes a huge difference to people, having that community. And this is something I do, because I used to suffer a lot with imposter syndrome, and now I rarely do, honestly. And one of the things that has changed for me is having a success journal, I call it. And it's literally an Excel spreadsheet for me, but I like Excel spreadsheets. Most people might want to have a nice written journal, but it's something that's really available to you. And every time you do you have an achievement or you get positive feedback or a compliment, you write it in there and you keep that close and you look at it all the time. Because even though this imposter syndrome is, you feel like all that evidence is fake, if you keep engaging with it, it starts to become harder to dismiss it as fake. Like if every day I'm reading, well, this is what all my clients have said, and this is all the things they've achieved with working with me, and I keep reading that, eventually I think, maybe I am good at this. Like I can't really keep questioning this because it's too much evidence. So that helps. And there's so many other things, but I guess like one third kind of final thing would be the self-talk. Everyone has a voice in their head that's like a critical voice, you know, that has various characterizations. Some people hear like one of their parents or one of their old bosses in their heads all the time. Sometimes it just feels like them, but it's that voice that says, you know, you're not good enough, you can't do this, you're going to fail. Those thoughts that you have, working on that and trying to like notice when those things are coming up and when those messages are coming, and realizing that voice, that thought is not true. There might be truth in it. There might be some reality somewhere, but it's not helpful and it's not true. Like your thoughts are not automatically true. I think people think if they think it, it's absolute gospel, but it's actually not. And having that space of saying, okay, I feel like I'm a failure, but what if that's not true? Like a really quick thought exercise you can do is when you have a negative thought, write down the opposite thought, like I am a success, for example, and then write down three pieces of evidence that show that that thought could be true. And the idea is to just separate yourself a bit and see, like, my thoughts are not real. I can just as easily think the opposite thing. And doing that work repetitively really, really, really starts to change the way that you're talking in your own head. Or I say talking in your own head, I don't mean like voices in your head, but your thoughts themselves will start to lessen their hold on you a bit.
I'll be blaming you when a judge picks up on what I'm doing in court and I'm just writing down, I'm a success, I'm a success.
yeah, absolutely. Send them my way.
But is it a mixture? Because that's practical. You've said it was practical, but it's verging on deeper psychology as well. Is it a mix of the two, really?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think the kind of more practical side of, you know, writing down the evidence and like building community and stuff, absolutely needs to be supplemented really with that deeper work. And it is possible, but it is harder to do that yourself. I think there are certain books that help guide you through that process. I'm not necessarily a fan of just buy a million self-help books and try and figure them all out, because it can be very overwhelming and not very helpful for a lot of people. But there is that, unfortunately, because our brains are literally wired and mapped out when we're very young, you know, so much when we're children and even when we're teenagers, any messaging we've had then is kind of baked into our brain. It's baked into our nervous system and our thought processes and our what they call like neural pathways of how we respond to external input. So it does take some work to undo it. And it can be really, really helpful, therefore, to do that work with a therapist or with a coach. There are lots of conversations about what is therapy and what is coaching and where it sits. But both groups can help you a lot with that, because it doesn't sit in the spectrum of severe mental illness, or it's kind of a common pervasive issue, right? And it's very forward looking. It's like, how can I now move forward, which is very coach central. So working, there are lots of kind of professionals that can help you with it, and it does take some deeper psychological work. I think you're absolutely right.
I did wonder as well, because we focused on the individual, but there's a societal role, and I'm looking at it from a position of my chambers, for example. What can we do as a workplace to combat that feeling for people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And actually, I've spent so much time kind of coaching these individuals, and I'm now moving more into working with organizations around this kind of challenge, which is really about building more inclusive cultures, like genuinely inclusive, not just kind of ticking a box and saying, oh, we've hired all these diverse people. It's like really how to make it inclusive, because so many people have that question of, well, I want to make our workplace more like this, but I absolutely don't know where to start. And we've tried putting policies in and we've tried this and we don't really know what to do. And really it is about building spaces where people feel respected, valued, and trusted for their unique and individual difference, really, and for what they bring to the table and what they offer. And that can be a more complex process that involves a lot of rethinking and restructuring around communication and relationship building and management structures and organizations. But a really, really simple starting point that I think is really often overlooked is literally just asking people. You know, like so many people are very reluctant to do this, but if you are, you know, in a more senior position or you're managing people and you're thinking, how do I make this more inclusive for them? Just sitting down one-to-one and having a conversation and saying, what do you need to feel, you know, trusted? What do you need? What would you need to feel at your best here and to feel safe and comfortable here? And it may be, depending on where people have come from and what the environment is like, that people aren't very open at the start with that. You know, they don't really want to share anything vulnerable. No, I'm fine. But it's like that, if they give you one thing, one small thing, you know, actually, I do feel like I'm being interrupted quite a lot in meetings, then make it your mission to go and try and observe that in meetings and try and make that change. And what that will do is immediately build that safety and that trust. And those small interactions actually mean so much more to individuals than I think people realize. And it very quickly can change culture by just, it's that ask people what they need and then listen. It sounds simple, but it's true.
It's not the most controversial proposition. And yet,
no.
And yet, so I mean, do you feel that the workplace, be it chambers or wherever, has that responsibility to kind of be conscious of this? We say syndrome, but clearly it's almost a simplification to call it a syndrome.
I do think it is a responsibility of workplaces, and I think it's a subject that sits in this wider issue of, you know, how are people feeling and showing up at work. And it is a really difficult process for leaders and managers to face, because it's changing a lot. But all of our workplaces, all across the board, kind of all started really in their current form in the Industrial Revolution, in a time when it was like, you're a number, you're a worker, and you all need to be doing the same thing at the same time. And our economy has changed and evolved, and we as people have kind of changed and evolved. So that, like, homogenous, everyone needs to be the same and do the same thing, no longer fits. And the fact that certain profiles of people have been associated with certain professions for a long time, and, you know, wealthier white straight men, for example, are a group that have been the mainstay of most of these professions for a long time. And now these other, as we diversify, the workplaces really need to, like, adapt and change with that diversity. And so I think it is the responsibility of those leaders to say, how can we adapt? Like, how can we change to this? Because apart from anything, I think there's a lot of reluctance because the system does work for some people and it seems to be going okay and we are doing well, actually. So I don't really want to change this. But the reality is, in what I've seen, places that have built more inclusive cultures, also the, you know, and I'm saying this as that group because it is the predominant group, but wealthier straight white men also are happier, also thrive more, because they can actually realize, oh, I don't have to live up to the expectation of masculinity or whatever is required of me. I can actually say, oh, I actually quite like to do this, or I feel quite passionately about this, and they're able to do that. And so actually everyone wins. Even though that sounds very utopian, it's true that that I understand the resistance to change, but also change it's not a zero-sum game where, like, some people will lose so that other people will win. It's actually a change which can be bumpy, but afterwards most people can be better off. So that's where I stand on it anyway, an optimistic view.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me that the people that are in the sort of position of ultimate control, the, like you say, the straight white man who comes from money, basically, need to be the, I suppose, the agents of change.
Yeah. And it's a thing where, you know, if you have power and influence, it's very difficult for people to take power and influence from someone, but it is very much easier to share power and influence with people. And so, and it doesn't have to mean a loss. I think a lot of people really feel that sense, but it doesn't have to mean that.
Gosh, well, yeah, I think we could go on and on, but it's so interesting. And I think hopefully it's whetted listeners' appetites to work with you, Samantha, because I think very clearly you know enormous amounts about this, and it would be invaluable to work with you. Thank you so much for coming on. Really,
you're
really
so welcome.
And as for us, we will be back soon. Let us know what you think by leaving us a review, ping us an email. Even if it's a topic suggestion, as I say, we're always willing to receive it. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.